with us now. And he's a Wellington-based science and technology journalist. Morning, Peter.
Morning. How are you doing, Catherine?
Really good, thank you. Now, there's a couple of billion-dollar tech deals Wellington truly worth keeping an eye on. Fill us in on these.
Wow. Well, Alex Kendall, former University of Auckland graduate, mechatronics, robotics, AI is his specialty, went to the UK to do his PhD at Cambridge University, set up a company called Wave, which is really about artificial intelligence to run autonomous vehicles. We've heard so much about self-driving vehicles, no one behind the wheel, letting the car do all the driving in a safe way. He came up with a system to allow this to happen. He's just raised $1 billion US, so $1.7 billion New Zealand. SoftBank is leading this coalition of investors into his startup. It's one of the biggest investments into an artificial intelligence startup in the UK. Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, is all over this, talking it up as an example of the UK's leadership in this. So absolutely incredible that this Kiwi, who by all accounts is one of the smartest kids who's come out of the University of Auckland, is leading the charge in the UK, raising huge amounts of money, and is very much going to be taking on Tesla, the big player in autonomous vehicles using AI to allow cars to control themselves. This is basically going to be a big rival to Tesla.
So the question is, he's doing this in London, right? Is there any connection back to New Zealand at all, other than it being his place of birth and education? And you know why I'm asking that.
Yeah, well, sadly, no. I think at least one of his colleagues until recently was a Kiwi, quite senior in the company as well, has since left to go and work for another stealth startup. It just shows, though, that wherever something big is going down in innovative things in the world, Kiwis are attached to it some way. So that is quite inspiring. But the frustration, you know, I have is that why don't we have a share of this? You know, why weren't we able to support this really smart kid to do some of the sort of foundational work on this here in New Zealand?
Well, how do we answer that question? You know, I mean, obviously it's a much bigger market, it's a much bigger capital market, etc., in the UK. But then, you know, there are flights and there is technology these days that can get you pretty close to market. But what does it illustrate about the gaps we've got here? Or is it just simply a case of he's that talented, he was always going to go?
Yeah, I think it probably is the latter. He went to Cambridge and he just came into contact with, you know, Cambridge is, and Oxford are just not only academic centres of excellence, but industry as well. AI research is really advanced there. We don't have an AI industry in New Zealand. We don't have a very strong AI research component here, and that's something I've been banging on about.
Does that need to change relatively rapidly?
Interesting. I was talking to the head of Callaghan Innovation, Stefan Korn, about this a couple of weeks ago, and they're obviously doing a massive reset and having to lay off scientists. And I said, you know, should we be going deep on AI? And he said, well, yes, but we've sort of missed the boat on that. So there's no point us trying to build large language models or compete with the big players who have multi-billion dollar budgets. What we should specialize in is the implementation of AI and how society interfaces with it. That's the sort of the value that we can add here in New Zealand. So even in that space, we're way behind. So we've got a lot of work on a lot of these emerging technologies to get up to speed. And that other deal that's just happened in the last week across the Tasman in Australia, the Australian government has put $1 billion into building a quantum computer. And that is another cutting-edge emerging technology, high risk but potentially high reward if it comes off. And that just shows the contrast between them making a strategic priority out of an emerging technology and us sort of floating along, not really bothering to do anything.
Just pause and come back to the AI for the moment, because I've just been watching this video of the autonomous vehicle that Alex Kendall's involved with here, with Wave.
Yeah.
I thought we were on a road to nowhere, frankly, with autonomous vehicles. I've been reporting on their imminent arrival for about 15 years. And here he is saying, this video shows Wave AI's autonomous vehicle driving through London with no LiDAR, no HD maps, no hand-coded rules, just pure onboard intelligence from our end-to-end neural. And is stopping for a pedestrian or a pedestrian crossing, which is great. But how come it's, like, doing that on the open road? Like, where are we at currently with the ability to use these vehicles?
Yeah, well, you know, it sounds great, but that's basically what Tesla has moved to over time, which is mainly using the cameras. Most new vehicles now come with a lot of cameras around them, and that, with some sensors, is generally enough to give computer vision enough input about the real world to actually allow artificial intelligence to make decisions in real time.
But legally, they're allowed to be out there in the middle of London, stopping at pedestrian crossings, hopefully, for people. That's not an issue now?
Well, they have permits to do that.
Right.
It started in Alex's case around Cambridge with delivery vehicles. He did a deal with the local food delivery company to put these sensors on their vehicles, so he was gathering lots of information. But the real sort of shift we've seen is the first wave of autonomous vehicles, they basically used LiDAR, you know, sort of laser technology to gather information from around the car to feed in to make decisions. We're moving to a world where if you take all the sensors and computer vision, take all of that information from hundreds, thousands of vehicles, you can inform this network in real time, using all of those vehicles to decide what is happening in the real world at any one time. So that is the approach that Elon Musk is taking. The difference is that his system obviously only applies to Tesla vehicles. What Alex is trying to do is sell this technology to everyone else, every other car manufacturer. So potentially, if he can pull this off, he has much, you know, greater number of vehicles on the road supplying that intelligence back to feed this AI system that will keep everyone safe on the road.
I mean, just looking at his story, it looked like he was there at the right place. He got a kind of a gig, a side gig working with a firm, and off you go. And I guess that's difficult to counter back here in New Zealand.
And just finally on that, you know, if he follows the path of many Kiwis who've done really well, and hopefully this is high risk, hopefully it does come off, you know, some of that money will come back to New Zealand. He will support. Kiwis remember their roots and how they were helped, and the foundational stuff he did at the University of Auckland, he won't forget that.
Yeah.
So hopefully he'll invest back here.
Well, let's talk about the quantum computing move, though, which again it just seems like it's this thing, this transformative thing that is just always just around the corner,
yeah.
Right? And just remind people the difference that it's going to make. One of the things that stands out for me is whether any of our encryption is going to be able to withstand the speed and volume of computation that can happen with quantum computing. Just give us the primer again.
Yeah, so this is the shift from classical computers, which we use now, and our supercomputers are, you know, very advanced and very quick at doing calculations, but shifting to basically relying on the fundamental quantum mechanics that underpin reality to do much faster computations at greater scale, and to capture those atoms, you know, at a very precise scale requires very sensitive computers, and there are only a handful of them in the world. They have to be maintained at very low temperatures. I've been and seen a couple of them in the US. They look beautiful. They look like sort of copper chandeliers, but at heart, what they can do is solve equations in seconds or minutes that would take hundreds, if not thousands, of years for classical computers to do. That is the dream, at least.
So come back to what Australia's doing right now, because there is kind of a cost-benefit or a risk-reward analysis you've got to make at some point. You've got to be realistic about at what point to get on board and what the local benefits are. What are they doing with $1 billion in PSI Quantum? This is a Silicon Valley company, right, founded by two Aussies. Is it based in Australia? It's based in Silicon Valley. What's their money? What's in it
for
the Aussie government and taxpayer?
It's based in Palo Alto. It's set up by two very smart professors from Australia. And that really is the extent at the moment of the Aussie connection. But what the Australian government is seeing here is an opportunity for this company, PSI Quantum, to build the first, what they say will be usable, quantum computer in Brisbane. They've committed to building a facility there. By the end of 2027, they will have an operational quantum computer. And what the Albanese government sees the appeal of this is they want to be a manufacturing centre for quantum computers. It's part of their sort of big industrial push to bring manufacturing back to Australia and to be world leaders in a lot of these advanced technologies. So between the Queensland state government and the federal government, they're putting in $940 million Australian dollars in grants, equity stake and loans. And very controversial because they have an advisory committee over there, a 15-person advisory committee on quantum technologies. They didn't go and ask for advice here. They just went and did this deal. And it really, I think there's a lot of FOMO there. They've put a lot of effort into their quantum industry, and they were worried that PSI Quantum would go and do this deal with some other country. I think the governments there thought, we want this to happen in Australia. Huge call, because it is high risk. This is experimental stuff. The approach they're taking is different to a lot of the conventional approaches to quantum computing. It's using photonics, which is different to the electricity-based approaches others are taking. So high risk, but potentially really high reward.
Okay, now Microsoft has done a deal with Te Tumu Pairua. Could you explain more, please?
Yeah, this is really interesting. You know, as we've talked before about these big multinational cloud computing companies building infrastructure in New Zealand.
And using our power, my view on that.
Yeah, using power, which in the world of AI is going to be significant power usage. So that is a valid concern. But another valid concern is data sovereignty. So, you know, Microsoft and AWS say we're solving that issue. And data sovereignty is about keeping your data within the sovereign state, so not sending it to another country, which then is subject to other countries' laws.
Storing it effectively overseas, let's think of it like that, in another jurisdiction where, let's just say, a federal agency could demand access to certain information.
That's right, yeah. So Microsoft and AWS and Google say, when we build our infrastructure in your country, that solves that concern once and for all, because we can bring all of that data back to New Zealand and it will be subject to New Zealand law. We've been waiting to see what the Maori worldview would be on this approach. And it turns out that, you know, just in the last week, it appears that Microsoft is doing enough to keep Maori organisations happy that Maori data sovereignty will be protected. Te Tuma Pairoa is the Maori trustee. It administers as a trustee or agent around 1,800 Maori land trusts around the country. So it's a relatively small agency, but has a very important role and deals with sensitive data. They've agreed to become an anchor tenant in Microsoft's data centers when they come to the Auckland region and turned on in the next year or so. So that is really interesting. That suggests that Microsoft has done enough to give them confidence that their indigenous data sovereignty will be maintained.
Interesting.
And it suggests that, you know, the Maori economy is massive, $70 billion and growing, that other, you know, iwi and Maori organizations may feel enough trust and confidence to actually work with these multinationals.
There might be some more sympathy for the amount of power that these data centres are going to need if this is the purpose for it, right? We'll continue discussing what New Zealand Inc. gets out of building ever more electricity generation at a cost to consumers here, only to have it used for, you know, being cheap renewable power comparatively, and not necessarily many jobs coming with it or whatever. But the argument that it's part of data sovereignty, that it's our data being supported, probably helps in this case, that's for sure. Now, Twitter founder abandons Blue Sky, goes back to X. I didn't notice. I didn't notice that X became Blue Sky.
I did know this.
No, this is the original Twitter founder. This is Jack Dorsey, of course, back when Twitter was Twitter and not X and Elon.
Yeah.
So what's happened to Blue Sky and what's happened to Jack?
Well, they've clearly had a falling out, you know. So Jack obviously sort of had Twitter sold out from under him with the sort of aggressive takeover by Elon Musk, and they've had a sort of a bit of a love-hate relationship. I think Jack Dorsey has expressed a lot of admiration for Musk's sort of free speech absolutism, but he's also very upset with how Musk really gutted Twitter and turned it into X, fired a lot of people who Jack Dorsey really loved at the company. So they seem to be back very much as friends. And this sort of offshoot that Jack Dorsey funded and set up, initially from within Twitter, but then was spun out as a separate independent entity and a new social media platform called Blue Sky, based on an open protocol, so open source software, which is great. That's Jack's sort of forte. But over the weekend, he, in response to someone asking on Twitter, he basically said, "I've got nothing to do with Blue Sky." He shut down his account. He's no longer on the board. He's gone and funded some other little startup social media company, and he's basically saying Twitter, or what's now X, is the place to be. That's the freedom technology, as he described it. So very much a return to the fold. And I think it really, what it comes down to is, you know, he was the founder of what became X. It still has, in social media, huge sway. And, you know, there was, again, FOMO. He's missing out on all the action there. He would rather be where a lot of the exciting stuff is going on, rather than struggling with a little startup that only ever had 4 million users trying to take on something like X.
If you can't beat him, join him, right? 2 Degrees is in trouble with the Commerce Commission over what? Sometimes the telcos find themselves in this situation. What's it in this time?
Well, they have what I think is a very good deal for their business users, where basically you can roam across the Tasman and not worry about data and voice sort of per day sort of feeds. It's all part of your business account, and you pay a bit more. You know, it's generally more of a premium account, but for a lot of business people, a lot of certainty is you know, they really like that. But it turns out that when they first started offering this deal back from 2020 to 2023, that free roaming deal for business users was actually capped at 90 days a year. And they didn't properly tell people about this when they were advertising it. So a number of customers went over there and then started receiving overage charges after spending 90 days in Australia. So the Commerce Commission has lodged some charges against 2Degrees, saying that was unacceptable. So we'll see how that plays out. 2Degrees has since corrected that, repaid people, and now that deal is genuinely an unlimited deal for those people who have signed up to it. But it's yet again another warning shot from the Commerce Commission against telcos. We've seen one, most of them actually at some point get pinged for not being clear enough in their advertising. So this is another example.
Thank you so much. Peter Griffin is Wellington-based science and technology journalist.